This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, Lynn Malcolm here. Welcome to Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and our series of Summer Science, where we take scientists into relaxed cafe and pub environments around the country. Today, we're dreaming and scheming about our genes. With the cracking of the final human chromosome this year, the entire human genome has now been sequenced, and the field of genetics is poised to dominate every aspect of our lives. New genetic discoveries are constantly being made, which could help predict anything from a person's IQ to their sporting prowess, propensity to develop cancer or alcoholism, or even the ability to use chopsticks. But will we ever have the technical know-how and the big bucks to turn these dreams into a reality? And do we really want to? This event was held at the International Congress on Human Genetics at the University of Queensland in August. So over to your ABC Science host, Bernie Hobbs.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Cafe Scientific, Gene Dreams or Gene Schemes. We're here live at the Red Room at the University of Queensland with a quintet of absolute geniuses. It doesn't just start with brilliant scientists and professionals. We've even got a Nobel laureate amongst us this evening. They're all pointing at one another going, oh, that must be her. No, that's him there. Our special guests to discuss the final draft of the human genome, what it means for us, what it'll mean for our kids, what it'll mean over the next 20 or 30 years for public health, our four special guest, Sir John Sulston from the Sanger Centre in Cambridge, Nobel laureate and leader on the Human Genome Project. Sitting between myself and Sir John is Dr. Ken Story. He's the Canada Research Chair in Molecular Physiology at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. On the other side of Sir John Sulston is Dr. Chris Barlow-Stewart, the Director of the Centre for Genetics Education at the Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney. Hey. And looking very much like a smug Ringo Starr down at the end of the panel is drummer, band member of occasional paying gigs and Executive Director of the Life Knowledge Park in UK and head of the Institute of Human Genetics, Professor John Byrne. Now, this is by far not the first ever kind of public discussion about genetics and genomes and what it means for us, but this is the first one I know of that's happened after the announcement that the human genome has finally been decoded. But I think we really need to do a bit of a quick where are we now, just to work out what it is that we know from decoding that genome. And I think the best way to do it is to take an example, a figure A of humanity, look at his or her particular qualities and see if we can ascribe any of those to pure genetics. Can I have a volunteer, Sir John? And do you mind if I call you John? Because it'll make it a much less
formal. I think I'd much prefer that, Bernie. Thanks very much.
I know you preferred it when I corrected you live on air during the Radio National quiz some years ago at the Genetics Congress in Melbourne. Just had to work
that's it. That's one thing I shall never be allowed to forget.
The highlight of my career.
And now, mine.
Thymine in DNA, uracil in RNA. Yeah. You'll remember it next time. Yeah. Now, let's look at this fine specimen of humanity. We have a man who's announced just recently he's 64 McCartney years of age. He's quite a good-looking chap, Caucasian, blue eye, grey hair, reddish sort of skin. We know he's a bit bright because even though he was not the greatest hit at university, I think, was it a 2B degree you got, John?
Something like that. Yeah. Don't remember it too well.
Let the past be the past, shall we? But moving on from that, you had terrific success after staring at a worm for 30 years.
Well, couple of years.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry, I thought it was more like 30. Working.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I let people believe because it sounded good on my CV. Yeah.
And it gives you this quality of patience and investigation.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Curiosity. As a kid, you like to take things apart and put them back together with hopefully the same number of screws.
Yeah, it didn't work too well with the worm, though. You could never get it back. Once it was squished, that was the end of it.
Yeah. All in the name of science.
I learned not to squish it. Okay. That was my achievement.
So far we know you're susceptible to premature greying. You're a bright lad. You seem fully physically functional. I know you ride a bicycle, so you're probably... Are you a bit athletic?
No, I wouldn't say that. I ride a bicycle. Let's leave it at that.
Right. So no particular...
In Cambridge, which is really, really flat.
Okay. Have you got any special talents or skills that might have a genetic basis?
I like pulling the weeds. I just weeded my leeks just before I came over here. They look beautiful.
Yeah, I love that work ethic. Now, I'm sure I've missed a few things, but just from what we've learnt from the human genome, we've got it out there, we've worked out what's a gene and what's not. What about John can we say is purely down to genetics? Professor John Byrne, you're a bit of an expert in clinical genetics. Can you add anything to the picture? What is due to genes?
I'll probably sound quite boring, really. I mean, there's not very much wrong with him. I mean, he's a reasonably good specimen of humanity, and I'm a clinical geneticist. I deal with people who've got problems, and John doesn't really have many.
He's a little short-sighted.
And I'm also a trained doctor, and so therefore you never divulge things about your clients that you should keep secret. I mean, I think what we've got to take apart is really what genes do. Genes define what we look like in terms we've got one head, two arms, you know, how many digits and so on. All that's defined in our genetic makeup. What you're really asking about is the degree to which our differences are defined by our genes. It's very obvious that the fact that he looks like John Sulston and fortunately doesn't look anything like Ken is down to his genes. And we know that that's genetic because if he had an identical twin, he'd have exactly the same face. And everyone in this room who aren't identical twins all have different faces. So he's got that face because of his genes. And we sometimes talk too much about medicine and medical things. I mean, it's just really our features are genetically defined.
Okay, but there are things like IQ, chopsticks, usability, a whole lot of things have been put down, sporting prowess, been put down to genetics. Chris Barlow, Stuart, is that true? I mean, can you say that anything is 100% down to genes?
Look, you might inherit a really good athleticism. So your genes say that you're going to be a footballer, you're going to be because your parents were good at sport. But if you don't train, if you don't put the hard yards in, you're never going to get there. So it's not all your genes.
You know, you can train as hard as you like. If you haven't actually got the basic equipment, then you're not going to succeed. No one puts money on a Japanese basketball team.
Vice versa works. You might have the genes, but if you don't put the hard yards in, you're not going to get anywhere.
That's true. Actually, I have to say, in the Olympics, it's always struck me that Australia never get any sprint medals, because I think all the people who got sent here were the ones who got caught stealing bread.
I love having a Brit on the panel.
Well,
let's not forget where the
convicts
came from.
I hope I get out alive after that.
That's actually true. When you look at the long-distance runners in the Olympics and you see the Ethiopian runners and they do fantastically, well, you think, yeah, that's a lot of genes. You know, but they've been probably running for a long time. So it's not as if they sat around and thought, yeah, I'm Ethiopian, I can run. You know, they've got to do a bit of practice as well. So it's just not your genes.
Okay, can we say the same thing then for disease? Because I remember being astonished a few years ago when the first sort of talk of gene therapy came out to find out that very few diseases or conditions are actually 100% caused by genes. There's just a handful. How are the rest accounted for? Something like the breast cancer genes. What's the environment? What are the causes?
Basically, we talked about this today at our conference at the International Congress here in Brisbane. The fact is that the Mendelian diseases, as they're called, named after Gregor Mendel, the guy with the peas, are really the exceptions to the rule because a particular gene is so important that if you break it, you get a problem and you get the problem every time. It's rare, but when it happens, it's great for us because we can track it through families. That's how we found the genes in the first place, and it allows us to understand what that gene does. And there are a couple of thousand diseases that run in families. Now, the problem that we have with breast cancer that you picked on is that about 1 in 20 women who get breast cancer have an inherited predisposition. But the trouble is they look just the same, as by and large, as all the other women who get breast cancer. There are a few differences. One is that they tend to be younger, and the other, which is Chris's main interest, is that they have a family history of it. And so we can sort of pick them out of the crowd, but not absolutely consistently. And most breast cancer is not just one gene. It's a genetic predisposition, maybe, and it's other factors, external factors. It might just be pure chance that if you live long enough, that thing might happen. So picking those two things apart is our big challenge.
The fastest growing disease in Australia, as well as in Canada and North America, is type 2 diabetes. It is a set of gene problems, both in your mitochondria as well as dealing with insulin. But really, what happens is you get old, you get fat, you eat too much sugar, and this triggers the problem. So you needn't be a type 2 diabetic, even though you have all of the gene problems.
This brings me to a question, Ken. This is a congress for human genetics that we're at here, and you're an expert in frogs. I mean, I know there are a lot of junkets that can give one an international conference to attend every year, but should you really have wasted yours on coming to a conference that had nothing to do with your area of research?
Well, that depends on what you mean. I'm more interested in what humans don't do but could do with their genes. I study a set of animals that can live in suspended animation. They can turn themselves off and you would think they're dead for days, weeks, or months at a time. I work on mammals that can hibernate at 0 degrees. I work on frogs that can freeze solidly. I can work on toads and turtles that live in the desert for years. You just add water, stir, and they come back to life. Those genes that they use to do that are somehow hidden in the human genome, except you don't use them. You're determined to stay at 37 degrees. And if I cool you down to 29 degrees, your heart stops. You're determined not to be able to be frozen solid because all your cells break. I think you're just wimps, and I'm looking for the genes hidden somewhere in the genome that I can turn on in order to preserve you forever. Or at least parts of you.
Do you ever get research students? Or does that speech freak them out a bit right at the start?
I always start out with a large number of research students, and by the end there's fewer and fewer.
The desiccation will do that. With gene therapy and, you know, all this stuff we keep hearing about, there are ways of predicting disease, ways of treating things. Now that we've got the human genome, John, is that really set to make much of a difference to the way that genes are tested for, that diseases are being treated?
Yeah, it's making a total difference, but the difference is not spectacular. People always ask, what's the big announcement at the Congress? You know, what's happened this year in the genome? That's the wrong question to ask. What's happening is the genome is completely permeating biology. And I tell you, if it hadn't been for the controversy about data release, then the genome would have been really invisible. The way I see the genome, it's like really good stage lighting. You know, at the end of the play, you know it's been lit, and the lighting has contributed totally, but you weren't aware of it during the action. So in this way, the genome is a set of tools, really, that every biologist uses. And it's not just the human genome, it's all the genomes that have been sequenced or released into the public. Everybody can look at them, compare them, and use them to find their genes. Now, one example of this is the way it's driving forward the cell biology and the subcellular biology of the nervous system. People are able to use the genome to pull out, analyze very complex protein mixtures and identify, because they've got all the information in the genome. You can shove a very complex mixture through a mass spectrometer, which is a clever device for separating out the actual materials of your body, and then getting the information from that machine, you can go back and look in the genome for the bits that they've been broken into. That's the kind of thing. It's a tool, it's the best tool that's come into being for many years in biology. It's really valuable that way. But don't ask, what's the genome done this year? Wrong question.
But oh, I'll
can I just follow that with some words with fewer syllables?
Yeah.
I mean, a good example is about 60 years ago, some geneticists worked out the blood group system. And as a result of that, we realized that why some people died when they had blood transfusions, that they got the wrong blood. So we set up a system for testing people before they had an operation. They got a genetic test called their blood group. And we have a national system in every country now collecting blood to give to people. And you don't even think about that as a genetic service, but it's a genetic screening service for everybody having an operation. And we have the similar testing for every pregnant woman for rhesus disease, and we give them an injection so the baby doesn't get damaged. And every baby gets tested for phenylketonuria that most people have never heard of, and nobody's ever seen, because we cure it at birth. These are all genetic tests, And what John's saying is really that the genome's going to do a lot more like that. So more and more of medicine is going to be written with genetic information, but you'll never know it. It's in the background. It just means that what you do actually works for the person instead of being ineffective half the time because you're giving the wrong people the wrong treatment.
Okay.
But it's actually, you know, when we started on this journey, we were looking at particular changes or problems in single genes that made a big impact on the body. But as we've learnt more and more, the picture is becoming more and more shady and murky because it's not only the genes, it's what you said before, it's an interaction with the environment. And just because you have inherited this particular faulty gene does not mean you're going to get the problem if you can change the environment. And so I think our greatest challenge, having mapped the human genome, is to find out what we can do to change the environmental factors. If we can identify them, we can do a lot more in preventive healthcare because you can't actually change the genes, despite talking about gene therapy, but we can change the environment.
Yeah, it's right. I mean, people say quite rightly that the big project Biobank, which is not unique, but it's the biggest of its kind at the moment, to collect a lot of genetic data and a lot of lifestyle data from about 500,000 volunteers in Britain. The important bit is the lifestyle collection. You know, the genetics is like a control. That allows you to get rid of the genetic factors because you can measure them. What you're really looking at is, like you say, the lifestyle factors. There's going to be a lot of new information coming out about what's good and bad for you from that program.
So that means that people are looking at the environmental factors in parallel.
Well, they're looking
with
at the interaction. I mean, I really like, let me mention Matt Ridley. I mean, Matt Ridley's title, Nature Via Nurture, I think is a very good way of expressing this problem. People are always asking, is it nature, is it nurture? Or they ask, what percentage is nature, what percentage is nurture? Matt Ridley's title of his book, which is really good and worth reading, Nature Via Nurture, what he's saying is every environmental influence, everything that happens to you is a combination of both. The genes working through in your body in a certain environment leads then to your grown-up nature. So that's the way to look at it, the two things going round and round.
To come back to why is Ken with his frozen frogs here? And the fact is that we as human geneticists need to look to people like Ken who's working with other species and look back at ourselves from the perspective of other species, and we see where the parallels and the comparisons are. And very often we can understand our own body makeup by looking at how it works in other species, and you know, he can look at things that we couldn't possibly look at in people. So that sort of comparative biology is critically important also in working out how fits together.
And actually, sorry, Ken.
I'm sorry, because unfortunately the environmental aspect of all disease comes down to don't eat anything that tastes good, exercise endlessly until you're sweaty and tired, and of course don't smoke or do anything interesting.
Can you tick any of those boxes yourself, Ken?
My theory is I'm not going to live forever, and I want my body to be as bad as it possibly can be in the coffin. I want to use it up right
well,
to
you're
the
ladder.
How about being as happy as it can possibly be anyway at all, right?
My theory is none of those things make you live longer, it just seems longer.
You know, this thing about the other species, though, reminds me of another thing about the genome. It's so important that we've looked at lots of species. You know, it was a real gamble putting so much effort back in the 70s and the 80s into the model organisms and looking at their biology in detail at the molecules. It was a real gamble because we didn't know at that time whether they would be really similar to ourselves, which is what all the work was being funded for, really, mainly for medicine, or were they just going to be all different stories? And it's turned out that every gene in our body, you can trace back its ancestry through to those model organisms and see the relationships. And so every little bit of mechanism that you find in another organism has relevance to us. It's the gamble works superbly.
Well, it certainly paid off for you with your 1 millimetre long transparent
worm. That's right. Yeah, I used to meet people at parties and they say, you spent your whole life on a worm and it was only 1 millimetre long. You couldn't see it except through a microscope, and then they turn away sadly.
It speaks volumes of a man who's very...
Then he got a Nobel Prize and they all invited him to dinner.
That's right. Don't talk about wallflowers at a party. Just talk nematode.
Same.
It's all right if you're with other wormy types, though.
Yeah, and gee, that sounds so
real fun
inviting. If we're getting to such an area where you can't say gene therapy is going to cure most things, does that mean that the day when that was being predicted 5 or 6 years ago when the human genome was first coming out, does that, not that it's gay, does that mean that the day is not going to come when people will turn up at a surgery and have their genes read and their whole... find out what's going to happen to them?
When I was talking yesterday, I actually used an example which works very well. My son is now 25 years old. He got a first class honours in philosophy, which means...
First class, do you hear that, John?
Yeah, no.
I like the switch from mine to our. His wife's in the audience.
Yes, I just realised it. We did it together, actually. But our son is now 25. He's got a degree in philosophy, which means he's unemployed. And he was standing in our backyard, and I took his picture next to a horse chestnut tree, which he planted when he was five. And I asked him why he was planting this conker, as we call him, and he said he wanted to grow a tree because he wanted a tree house. And I thought that was a really neat idea. And there was nothing wrong with the concept. It just takes a long time to grow a tree to build a tree house. And your problem is in the media is you want everything to happen, you know, by tomorrow's news or by next week. And this is going to work. And so is Jamie's treehouse. It's just going to take about another 20 years to get it big enough and strong enough. Once we've got another 20 years' worth of analysis on the basic information the genome's given us, and we can compare it to those tens of thousands of people and work out what the risk factors are in terms of their relative value, we'll begin to do that sort of personalised medicine. It will come. So you'll go to a doctor, and he will not just give you the drug out of the book. He'll give you the drug that suits your metabolism. And he'll treat your cancer. In fact, we were just discussing earlier, there's been a really big breakthrough with breast cancer. The BRCA2 gene, the BRCA2 gene, is a particular inherited predisposition. And some very clever scientists, I know one of them, he's on the paper, published a paper about a month ago, which showed that the BRCA2 gene has this particular job of repairing broken DNA. And there's a thing called a PARP inhibitor, which was our university helped to develop, which breaks DNA in such a way that you've got to have BRCA2 to put it back together. So if you've got a cancer cell that's got a cancer because of the BRCA2 genes out of action, and you give it this drug, it dies. The rest of your body can repair the damage, so it's okay. So it's close to being a magic bullet, but only for BRCA2 cancer. So we're reaching that point quite quickly where when you come in with breast cancer, you're not going to get off-the-shelf treatment. You're going to get BRCA2 treatment or other treatment. So it's going to change the whole way we approach this genetic testing. And I think that's going to change our view of genetics in the next few years.
But what that does is, right now, access to genetic testing for looking to see if you've got a faulty BRCA2 gene is because of your family history. So here you have a woman who develops breast cancer. Out of the blue, she's suddenly told that your breast cancer is due to an inherited predisposition to breast cancer. So there's another then whole ripple effect throughout the family, which is quite different to the way we're using genetics now, because right now we go to a woman and there's already a knowledge about breast cancer in the family. And if that knowledge isn't there, comes as a big shock, and we have to work out how we're going to handle that. So it's more about not only using the testing for important diagnostic treatment and guiding the best treatment possible so that we're not doing this sort of blasting with the drugs that we do now. So while on the one hand it would be better diagnostically, we need to have our radar out to say, yeah, but what does it mean then? How are we going to handle the implications for the rest of the family? And I don't think we've got there yet.
Well, Chris, you see these people every day. I mean, you work in genetic counselling. You were the first accredited genetic counsellor in Australia. There's one of the big discussions is whether people should be told what's wrong with them, whether they should be told if a gene is good or bad. What's the reaction like for most people? Can you generalise when people find out that they have a predisposition to something?
Well, that's why we have a team of professional genetic counsellors who work with clinical geneticists, who work in a team to address the implications for the family. Because finding out that something is inherited in your family, for some people, it's a stain on the family. You know, they're dealing with a cancer diagnosis and then they're dealing with all these other things that they've got to talk about. They're worried about their children. They're worried about their children's risk. They're worried about their sisters. They're concerned about what might happen as a result of knowing that they are at increased risk. What will that mean for access to insurance?
There's a key word here, which is worry. And one of the things we often forget about is understanding how people interpret risk. I often, when I'm talking in the clinic to people, I say that if you met someone who just won the lottery, they would be the sort of people who put money on a horse because they're feeling lucky. People who come to a genetic clinic feel unlucky. They're the ones who had something wrong with them, or the baby had something wrong with them. And so when you give them a risk, they interpret it very differently. And one of our big challenges in all of this is to try and not make people feel really burdened by this knowledge inappropriately. I mean, just since all these people are sitting here in total silence, can we just ask a question of the audience? I mean, put your hand up if you think a 1% risk is a high risk or a low risk. Put your hand up if you think a 1% risk is a low risk. And put your hand up if you think a 1% risk is a high risk. OK, now, most of the people, since this is radio, the people in wearing red, most of the people here thought 1% was a low risk. Well, there are about 100 people in this room, and I'm sorry to tell you, but we actually planted a small explosive device under one of the seats in the room, which is going to go off in exactly 3 minutes. Now, you're OK. It'll only kill the person sitting on that seat, and it's a very low-risk situation. Yeah, but you're fine. There's a 99% probability it won't kill you. Now, the thing is that when you suddenly get confronted by that 1 in 100 risk of you dying now, that's a very different perception. And in the same way, if your mother died of breast cancer or your father died of prostate cancer, your perception of a risk is different. And this whole thing about genetic testing is coloured by that, because people are suddenly told you've got this gene. It's only a 50-50 chance that, you know, you're going to get this or that, but, you know, that's an incredible burden to carry around. And what we've got to learn is how we carry that effectively without killing people, you know, in other words, stopping them living their lives because of this fear. And as Chris was saying, what we've also got to remember is that this is a predisposition most of the time. It doesn't guarantee you're getting the disease. It gives you the chance to avoid it and change your life, or maybe start a surveillance program that will prevent it.
Professor John Byrne, Director of the Institute of Human Genetics in the United Kingdom. I'm Lynne Malcolm on ABC Radio National with our Big Ideas series of Summer Science. Since scientists have now sequenced the entire human genome, what can we do with this knowledge, and what do we really want to do? The other panellists, along with John Byrne, are British Nobel laureate Sir John Sulston, Dr. Chris Barlow-Stewart from Sydney's Centre for Genetics Education, and Dr. Ken Storey, molecular physiologist from Carleton University in Canada. Now back to the panel with your ABC Science host, Bernie Hobbs.
So if you had to decide, should people find out or not what they've got, if they have a predisposition?
I think we're all going to have to get used to the idea. We're going to have to know. You know, and what we talked about earlier about breast cancer treatment. If, in fact, a woman comes into the hospital and in order to treat her properly, we have to do a genetic test, then she's going to get told that she's got the gene for breast cancer. And therefore, her relatives are going to have to come to terms with that just at the time she's developed the breast cancer. And we're going to have to learn how to cope with that, because at the moment that happens relatively rarely. In future, more and more of us are going to get risk factors in our genetic makeup.
I think that's going to be really helpful, the fact that it's going to become a grey area as we get away from the simple Mendelian ones. But I'd like to go back to something Chris mentioned in passing, and we really should address here. We can't totally remove the burden, obviously, of knowing about your own life, and, you know, that you've suddenly realised that maybe you've got an increased probability of cancer or dying or something at some point in the future. But what we can do, and we must do, I think, with some urgency, is to remove the other burden, which is causing havoc, actually, in genetic testing, I believe, which is people's unwillingness to be tested if they're fearful of the effects on their interaction with society, specifically interaction with insurers and interaction with employers. And this is something which on both the Australian HGAC and the British HGC, the Human Genetics Commission, also in the US, there's a bill going through Congress to try to outlaw the discrimination against people because they've had a genetic test and have got a result of some kind or another.
Where now, are we at with it now?
What?
Where are we at with it now?
We're nowhere. We're just saying we've got to do something about this. Now, the breast cancer genes, for example, I mean, there are cases certainly in America, I believe, that where people have been refused employment because they've got a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation on the grounds that they may become a liability to that employer. Now, in the US, it's a more serious difficulty because there you're dealing with private health insurance all the time. There is no public health insurance, right? It mostly falls on the employer to carry the insurance premiums. So obviously they have a much bigger issue. But here and in Britain, we still have the issue about life insurance, that people need to buy houses, and the possibility, as has happened again, with rarely, that an employer will turn somebody down for a job. Now, I think it's very simple. I think we should, like other kinds of discrimination that we've outlawed, like discrimination between the sexes, discrimination between people of different races, we may not do it perfectly yet, but we've got those things through in law. And I think think we've got to do just the same thing with the genes. So people at least can go for genetic tests in the knowledge they will not be discriminated against in these ways. It will still leave the worry, the personal worry about yourself and the family, but at least we must take that burden off.
Would we end up making illegal those insurance companies that only insure women because they don't have driving
problems?
Well,
that's a very interesting case. I suspect we might well end up with getting rid of that as well, and that might be the price to pay for equality. I think we just have to work it out. There certainly should not be the situation that people are fearful of genetic tests because of the social consequences.
The other issue about people being fearful of genetic tests is within the family too. You know, one of the issues that is raised by John talking about this new finding that we'll be able to do more diagnostic testing on people who don't have a family history, who don't have an experience of breast cancer perhaps in the family, is that when you find out that, it's then your responsibility to tell the other family members that they're now at risk for something they never thought about. And it's being the bearer of the bad news. It's being the one who's got to take this out and be the person in the family charged with this task. Now, that is a very difficult task for the best of us. So I think one of the things we've got to come up with is ways to help that information get out within families. Because at the moment in Australia, a doctor, for instance, cannot contact a relative if they are at increased risk for breast cancer, for example, because that condition is not serious and imminent. You can only contact a relative if they are at risk of developing a condition that is serious and imminent, such as HIV or Hep C. So you're allowed to breach confidentiality for those reasons. So the responsibility is discharged to the family. And that's a huge and onerous task. We launched the Family Health History Campaign last week precisely to encourage the conversation within the families. Talk to each other. Develop your family health record. Keep this as a valuable document, because this is the record of the family history of conditions. This will be your gateway to using the technologies that will enable you to determine your risk if you wish to.
Well, see, my only concern is, I mean, if you can put on your driver's licence that you want to be an organ donor when you're killed, and that's your clear and obvious wish, and if you can say that you want to be not resuscitated if you're in a vegetative state, and your family can override that, I mean, what makes you think that a family is going to work together on something like this, if no matter what your wishes are?
I think that's the challenge. I think we have to encourage people to realise the benefits of knowing your family history. In some cultures, we need to recognise that it's a stain on the family line, or it's considered a weakness in the line. But let's try and encourage that to be a very positive thing.
Ken, you're chortling away at the end here.
The actual answer for organ donation, for instance, is to realise that humans are humans and they need to be regulated. You can't rely on their good nature. Right now,
the benevolent dictator has spoken.
Right now, when you die, the government presumes that your organs go with you and that you and your family have to choose to bury them or burn them or follow some religious precept. All that has to be done to solve organ preservation and organ transplants in any country is to change the law. You write in something called presumed consent. What this means is that when you die and you're dead, the government presumes they can take your organs and do what they want to it. So instead of 15,000 people waiting for a liver, there'll be 15,000 dead people whose livers are presumed to be used for transplant.
It'd be a terrible stain on the family if your liver didn't get used then.
No one need ever know.
And Ken, with your techniques, we could freeze all those livers.
There would be no need for the science of cryopreservation at all. I would be out of business very happily if we had presumed consent.
The other thing, of course, we can do, Ken, is actually develop our stem cell program and actually sort of, you know, grow someone a replacement liver, and then all of this morbid chopping bits out of dead bodies can be avoided.
It could be good. It would be easy if you had just kept your umbilical cord, because your umbilical cord presumably has your own stem cells in it. You should have thought of that 20 or so years ago.
I'm thinking 40, just glancing around the room, but That might just be it, my friends. Just sure. Want to get to the audience's questions. And we've got, jumping out of his skin right here, if you could just say your name and who your question's for.
Okay, my name is Gert-Jan van Ommen, and I've been in Brisbane for the meeting in 1998 as president of YouGov. One of the things on the genetic testing where people are, they're not only concerned for jobs and for insurance. What makes a big difference in their view is whether there's a therapy. So it's going to change. If you look at Huntington's disease, where there's no therapy, then only like 20%, the 20% that are most scared of it, actually go for the testing. If you look at breast cancer or colon cancer, where there is a therapy, but the therapy is draconic, you either take off your breast or you take out your intestine or your colon, then about 50% will go for the testing. If you have familial hypercholesterolemia, that's too much fat, then you take a pill and then basically you're fine. And then 90% comes for the testing. So this is going to change through time.
That's a good point, actually. For the number of tests that we've got for conditions, how many viable treatments do we have? What's the match there? Have we got many more tests than we have treatments?
I mean, that's one of the problems. Our diagnosis is way ahead of our treatment. But as Gert-Jan says, I mean, basically, the minute you've got a treatment, it transforms the entire position.
But hang on, there is a treatment, which is to avoid the birth of people with this particular genetic condition. That applies to everything. And it's very interesting that there's a kind of a backlash against this, where people are saying they don't want to apply genetics in this way in prenatal diagnosis. Right?
If you take Duchenne muscular dystrophy, one in every three is a new mutation. There's no way of avoiding.
Yeah. No, so all right. There are many, I'm just saying that if we can't just restrict it to the treatment, which is minute, there's a huge amount can be done by prenatal diagnosis. And this should be recognised and accepted.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and prenatal diagnosis is an incredibly important part of our job. And the reason that we in the UK and here in Australia, they've got very well-developed genetic services, is primarily because planning your family is something that people consider they should be able to do. And if you've got a genetic disorder in childhood and you want to avoid another affected child, then prenatal diagnosis is available. But that isn't a treatment. I think what Gert-Jan's talking about is being able to take a tablet and be cured.
No, I know. But I'm just saying that it's very important to realise that we do have this recourse.
Sure.
Maybe we shall have more and more treatments. Maybe some things won't be treated. But what I wanted to bring into focus, which I think is hugely important, is that some people in some communities, the deaf community has been notable in this, for example, in Britain, I don't know how it is here in Australia, have rebelled against this and say we want more deaf people to be born who are like us. Now, I regard that as frankly selfish. I don't think it's correct as a parent to do that, but they believe it is. But the point is that we do have this kind of power, and we should set it alongside the possibility of postnatal or adult treatment as one of the ways we can use this information in a constructive manner.
And can I just say, 20% of people with a family history of a late-onset neurological condition like Huntington disease, for which there is no treatment, take the test. And there is no treatment, but they take the test because they want to use the information for life planning, for whatever reason. So we can't make blanket statements about the fact that there is no treatment.
Don't you think Huntington's disease in some ways has done us a disservice? This is a disease that was one of the first we cracked. Because it ran in families, it's highly penetrant, you can't treat it, it's a horrible disease. And it sort of coloured the way we manage genetic disease in families, because everyone approaches everything, genetic testing, as if it's a predictive test for Huntington's. If it's a predictive test for a condition for which you get a tablet and you're cured, you know, we shouldn't be saying, let's sit down and talk about this for 3 days. You know, you just do the test. If you've got the disease, you get the tablet. If you haven't got the disease, go home. You know, I think we need to get a little bit away from that wringing of hands and more towards what a doctor would do in a clinic. I mean, a good example, there's a condition called neurofibromatosis, which gives you brown marks on your skin. And if you were going to do a predictive test for that, you'd have to talk about it for days. But nobody stops you taking the kids' clothes off and saying, oh, look, you've got brown marks on your skin. You know, I mean, you just did a diagnostic test just by looking at the patient. And you know, we sort of treat genetic testing as somehow completely different from clinical examination. And I think what's going to happen over the next 20 years is having your gene looked at is going to be like having your skin looked at by the dermatologist. It'll just be part of your workup. And as that happens, it'll demystify a lot of this because it'll be much more treatable and manageable.
Now, I think that's absolutely true, but there is a lag time. before we find the genetic test and then we find the treatment. Sure. So we are going to have to be sitting down and talking to people about whether they want the test for a long time until we get the treatment. And then the paradigm changes. That's fine, but we can't say dismiss what we're doing now.
No, I'm not dismissing it. I just think sometimes, I mean, I come from medicine as a doctor originally before I took to the stage, and so you know, I kind of can relate to GPs and neurologists who just want to get on and treat the patients. And I work with genetic counsellors who are coming much more from a counselling tradition, who want to sort of talk about it for a while and have a cup of tea and go home, come, you know, and talk to the dog.
Excuse me, we don't get cups of tea.
It's red wine
unless
all the way.
I'm just trying to wind up the genetic counsellors in the audience. But, you know, I mean, they're, because they aren't used to having sort of treated patients in the way that doctors grew up doing it, they're much less enthusiastic about just diving straight in and doing it, and more driven by that sort of Huntington's disease scenario. And I do think there's a bit of a clash of cultures there between the medically qualified geneticists and the counsellors who come from a more non-interventionist tradition.
You're listening to ABC Radio National and our Big Ideas series of Summer Science. We're discussing the growing scientific field of genetics.
And we do have another question. I'm not sure if it's related to that. Veronica?
No. Mine's sort of two-tiered. One is just a simple question. Is the BRCA2 gene one of the Mendelian genes you were talking about?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, it is. It runs in families, and if you get the gene, it's a 50-50 chance of getting it or not, and if you get the gene, there's a very high risk of cancer. Having said that, most of these things we call Mendelian, it's not everybody who gets it. You know, we start bringing in phrases like incomplete penetrance and variable expression, because most of these things don't always happen to everybody. And so it's sort of, the closer you look at most things, the harder it gets to define where the edges are.
Is there any way of knowing?
It is a Mendelian trait. That's the one that we've picked out of the crowd. Most of them don't run that way.
Well, then, in my family, for instance, there's four generations of women who died of breast cancer, and I have the BRCA2 gene. And I'm just thinking, if lifestyle meant a big thing to these women dying of cancer, then surely over those four generations, all our lifestyles were very different, but nonetheless, they've all succumbed to this.
Sure. And I think the answer to that is that there are lifestyle factors, you know, and we talk about how much weight you carry and exercise and diet and all these things can make some difference. If you've got a highly penetrant gene, it doesn't make enough difference. And that's why we have to put you on a particular surveillance program with mammography and actually catch these things early.
I'm just having them off. Thank you very much.
Well, okay, have them off. But that's what we do for colon cancer. Breast cancer is a much more emotive decision to have mastectomies because of the importance of the breast in society. But having said that, it's interesting, certainly in our society in the UK and here in Australia, I think it's a more acceptable option, especially if you've got reconstruction and a pretty good result from that. In the future, we will maybe not have to go to that extreme. My main research project is testing a very simple set of treatments for people with a high risk of bowel cancer. And our hope is that we won't need to take their colon out. We can just change their diet, give them some aspirin, give them some other treatments, and suppress their cancer risk. But also, the other big thing we've been doing recently is improving the surveillance. So using MRI instead of mammography is much more effective. And we've now done a big national study in the UK which shows that MRI scanning of the breast will pick up very early tumours at a treatable stage. So for your children's generation, I don't think we'll need to revert to that level of intervention. I think we'll pick up the lumps much earlier, we'll zap them from outside with some clever ray or beam and prevent the cancer before it really gets going, and then you don't need to have surgery. Some people are even suggesting, for example, that these PARP inhibitors I told you about, once a year, someone with a BRCA2 predisposition takes a course of PARP inhibitor just in case there's a tumour starting. You know, you actually sort of zap them once a year and catch the cells on the way in. I mean, that's a bit of an extreme suggestion, but you can imagine that, you know, becoming a very realistic proposition for the future. So what you're doing now might not be necessary in the next generation.
Your name?
Philip. Hi, this question goes out to all of you. I was just wondering, in my lectures I've heard about a reasonably new area of research, RNA silencing, with small molecules of RNA are used within the cell to silence genes. And what might that mean for the way we treat diseases in the future?
Well, I mean, it's mainly a tool for research at the moment and actually allowing us to switch genes on and off. And it's particularly useful in these experimental animals we're talking about, like zebrafish and worms frogs. And things and frogs. But in fact, there is some research to try and sort of switch off a gene or change the way a gene works so that it does less harm. And in fact, the guy sitting next to you, Gert-Jan van Omen, is leading one of those research projects in Europe, which I referred to slightly incorrectly in my lecture, and he very kindly didn't correct me. But the idea is that this sort of technology of getting in between the gene and its product and affecting the way it's expressed. For example, we talked earlier about Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It's a very severe disease. Children end up in a wheelchair by the age of 11. And the research project, which Gert-Jan and his colleagues are running, is using genetic material, nucleotides, to actually sort of switch the gene so that instead of it producing a very abnormal protein, it just produces a slightly abnormal protein. You still end up with weak muscles, but you don't end up in a wheelchair at 11. And it would greatly reduce the severity of the disease. And we're all going to try and help to get that project off the ground. So that sort of technology could bring in the future the potential for changing the life course of diseases. Even if we can't cure them, we maybe slow them down a little. Is that a reasonable summary, Gert-Jan? Gert-Jan is nodding for the audience.
Speaking for the animal's point of view, even though you're right, this is an experimental technology in humans, animals have known about small RNAs blocking genes for evolutionary time. Small mammals like ground squirrels and bats can hibernate. They drop their metabolism, they drop their temperature to 0 degrees. One of the things that shuts down their transcription, one of the things that turns off 99% of their genes is a flood of natural RNAIs. They're called microRNAs. And they're naturally produced during hibernation and flood out into the nucleus to turn off all genes. It's one of the things we're working on to transplant mammalian organs, is you take out the organ and put in these natural small molecules. Mm-hmm. So in nature, this is widely used. It's used to turn off the genome of animals that estivate and freeze. And it's only now being used as a sort of invasive technology in humans. Humans are always the last to know.
But I mean, that's a good illustration of, I mean, we look at a lot of the drugs we use now are actually natural compounds from plants that have been produced in nature, and we've adapted them into medications. And we were asked earlier why we've got this strange freezing frogman here. The fact is, a lot of our future treatments are going to come from looking at how nature deals with strange situations. And it may well be, for example, that instead of what we do now, if we want to operate on a kid with a heart defect, is we stick them in ice and we cool them down so that we can open up their chest for an hour and stop their heart. This sort of technology experiment, you're taking knowledge from animals' models, might mean that you could actually close down that child for a whole day by using his technology and then improve the surgery dramatically. So maybe not. So I think you've actually touched on a good illustration of how looking at comparative model systems in plants and animals can open up ways of approaching human diseases that were previously unimaginable.
Just to put this microRNA thing on a very firm footing, the first one was found in the nematode. And
didn't you get the Nobel Prize for that, John?
And it changes its sex from male to female. So there you go.
Wow.
Could be handy in humans, maybe.
Excellent. We look forward to more on that. John Sulston, sorry. One thing you've been very vocal on is the patenting of genes, which was huge news a number of years ago, and we haven't heard much about it lately. What real impact has patenting of genes had on the genetics industry, on the development of pharmaceuticals, on research? Has it really been the big bad guy it was made out to be?
I think, like all the other things that we're talking about, it's still early days. I mean, we were debating this in our session first thing this morning, and Gert Matjes has put a lot of effort into altering European patent law so that we can have free testing of the two breast cancer genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2, against the wishes of the American corporation that owns the portfolio there. I think the thing which we, and it's a balance, it's not like we're all going to die tomorrow, but there is a balance between the public good and the private profit in the sense of scientific communication. And the thing that I like to talk about is, if you lock all the data down so that people can only access it in certain ways defined by the owner of the data, then in fact it limits their research activity a great deal, and in particular it limits their research communication. The thing that comes out of a Congress like this and looking at the great variety of presentations is just how extremely complex the whole thing is. This is something we've touched on in all sorts of ways. We talked about genes and environment. I talked earlier about the complexity in the nervous system. We really need everybody, all hands on deck, everybody working together to sort these things out. Things that get in the way of open communication are not going to be helpful. They will allow a sort of cure or a supposed cure to be produced and advertised maybe for a particular narrow thing. What they won't do is to be so effective at advancing knowledge. And so I just think it's very important to keep a big, very active public domain, to give as much of the data as possible in the public domain and limit the use of patents to quite narrow things that really are inventions, really have got to the point of being a marketable product.
The problem we had with Myriad was that they got a hold of the patents on the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes and then said, no one else can test these genes except us. You've got to send the samples to us. And they wanted to close down our diagnostic labs, which was completely ridiculous. And it just generated this huge backlash from our community, which has been successful. But in fact, the argument is a very straightforward one. If you go back to the late 19th century when the periodic table was discovered and all the elements started to be understood in terms of their relationship, it was realised there were elements that hadn't yet been discovered but must exist. And it was decided that when they were discovered, no one could own them. You couldn't patent them. They were God's creation. They just were there. And most people instinctively think, well, the same must apply to our genes. I mean, they're in frozen frogs and all over the place. These are not something that these guys wrote and invented. They just found them. And they didn't even find them on their own. The only reason they were found because we gave them lots of family data for the mapping process. It was a collaborative effort. So it was a completely unreasonable thing to do. And what, as John says, what it did was it slowed everything down. Imagine if you had a gene chip, which is now coming along, that could test for 10,000 genes. Imagine if you had to get 10,000 licenses for every one of those genes on the chip. It's got to slow you down. And it's not where entrepreneurs should be coming in. They should be coming in and making the chip, not owning the gene.
Yeah.
Immortality from genetic research, the last big claim in the media in the last 5 years. Ken, thoughts on immortality? You're a big fan of hibernation and cryogenics. What are your thoughts on the promises of genetics for immortality?
Well, the good news is, even now, for a fairly reasonable price, cryonics companies will freeze you and keep you in a state of suspended animation until the future, a couple hundred years, when whatever went wrong with you is absolutely curable.
How reasonable is that price?
It's only about $128,000. But if you don't have that much money, what they have is what's called a head preparation. Shortly after you're finished using your head, they remove it and put it into liquid nitrogen. They then store that head until a time when human cloning will be up and running, and they'll just stick it on whatever body happens to be going at the time. Presumably Brad Pitt on the one hand and Angelina Jolie on the other.
You're in favour? A big tick from you, Ken, for this?
It sounds like a good idea. It doesn't work in real life, but it sounds like a very good idea.
The trouble is, it's suspended death, not suspended animation.
And anyone who agrees with it, I have some very interesting shares I'd like to discuss with you.
And what happens if you stop paying, Ken?
Oh, you pay everything up front. It's essentially an American phenomenon. You pay everything up front. The reason we know it doesn't work is that when you pay for everything up front, they leave town. And a lot of the cryonics patients have been found thawed.
Oh,
you pay your money, you take your chances. We're from North America.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in thanking our four speakers tonight on the title.
Bernie Hobbs was your host in today's discussion, Gene Dreams or Gene Schemes. This event was held at the International Congress on Human Genetics at the University of Queensland in August and was produced by Abby Thomas. On the panel were Nobel laureate Sir John Sulston from the Human Genome Project in Cambridge, Dr. Chris Barlow-Stewart, Director of the Centre for Genetics Education at Sydney's Royal North Shore Hospital, Professor John Byrne, Director of the Institute of Human Genetics in the United Kingdom, and Dr. Ken Story, molecular physiology researcher at Carleton University in Ottawa. And don't forget, you can download our programs onto your computer or MP3 player for the next 4 weeks to listen to at your leisure. Just go to abc.net.au/rn and click on Big Ideas in the program list. Thanks to sound engineer Leila Shunar. I'm Lynne Malcolm, and do join me next week for Big Ideas on ABC Radio National when we leap forward half a century to consider the future of one of our most precious natural resources, water. Happy New Year. Bye for now.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.